When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Forever Dog.
This episode of The Need to Fail is brought to you by ads. Ads are dumb. I mean, they're great for informing you about products, but they manipulate your brain into thinking that you need them. They convince you that you'll be a happier person when you have them. Because see, look at all these joyful models and off-brand celebrities using our thing. Hell, don't I sound happy just talking about it? But you know that happiness will go away pretty quickly after buying that thing, and a new ad will come along and make you feel deficient and bad about yourself for not having their product. Damn, ads, you perpetual tricksters, you pokers of insecurities, you shamers of fortune. I love you. I hate you. We need you. No, we don't. Ads, a shorter caveman way to say advertisements.
Sometimes you need to fail. The need.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to The Need to Fail for the final time. My name is Don Finelli. That's it. I'm running this thing for the last time here. It's my final episode of this podcast. Many emotions, mostly relieved. It's been a lot of work. I've counted, I think I have like over 300 pages of notes that I put into this thing. Just put in hours of work and, you know, it never really became more than a hobby or a side hustle, as the kids say nowadays, as much as I tried. So I'm going to break this intro down into three parts, okay? I'm going to thank a bunch of people first. I'm going to give my final thoughts on all this failure podcast crap. And then I will introduce my guest, okay? So feel free to skip all this shit, as per usual. So yeah, first up, let me thank a bunch of people here. Thank you to Forever Dog for taking a chance on this thing. Thanks to the various folks at like Vulture and the AV Club for highlighting The Need to Fail a bunch of times. Thanks to my friend Anna Rubinova for helping me out towards the end of my run with Forever Dog. She stepped up big time. Thanks to James, my OG sound dude back in 2013. Thanks to Alejandro, my... I don't know what I'm doing. I need help, resource. Thanks to everyone that emailed me with their stories or took a chance and called the Faily Fail phone number, which I'll keep active, by the way. Okay. And of course, a huge thanks to all my guests who took the time to talk to me about an issue that's kind of, I guess, uncomfortable to talk about, and for sharing your stories, for sharing your methodologies. Obviously, thank you. Thank you, my listeners. Thanks for taking this ride with me, for proving that people do want to hear stories like this. Specifically, thank you to my Patreon contributors. You were with me with and without bonus content. But you really helped me pay for equipment and my post-production software. We wound up raising almost like $1,000 for Donors Choose over the years, which is a charity that's near and dear to my heart. So thank you so much. Whether you did it for 1 month or these last few years, I really am humbled by your generosity. So thank you. And last but not least, thank you to my wife, Laura. Jesus, for putting up with all of this shit. thanks for being the best mom, best wife, best friend. I love you. So I thought it would be fun, you know, for the final episode, for me to just take a step back and objectively figure out if this podcast about failure was a failure. Okay. So I did something I've never done before, which is look up the actual definition of failure, like the textbook definition or the Google definition. Took me over 160 episodes, but here we are. I finally actually looked up the definition of failure. I typed in failure definition into Google. Here's what popped up. Number one, lack of success. What? That's the number one. Okay, so the dictionary is telling me, hey, you need to know what success is to know what failure is. Okay, so I typed success definition into the Googles, and it said lack of failure. No, I'm just kidding. It said the accomplishment of an aim or purpose. I said, okay, the accomplishment of an aim or purpose. That is what success is. So by that definition, failure is the lack of an aim or purpose, or not accomplishing an aim or purpose. That makes sense to me. Not accomplishing an aim or purpose. Okay, so let's take a look at this. What was my aim of this podcast? Well, I had listenership numbers I wanted to hit. I had Patreon numbers I wanted to hit. I had income numbers I wanted to hit. Ad numbers I wanted to hit. Rating and reviewing numbers I wanted to hit. I wanted to create more relevant bonus content. I wanted to create a community that was more public and interactive. I wanted to get some more help with production. I had specific guests that I wanted to interview. So those were my aims. Those were my goals. Okay. So overall, looking at those, I failed. I failed pretty miserably. I hit some initial numbers, but man, did it fall off and I didn't get to, you know, most of the stuff I wanted to do. So I didn't hit my target. So yes, I failed. But what about purpose? Right? It said aim or purpose. What was the purpose of this podcast? Well, that's pretty simple. It was to help people, specifically to make people feel less alone when things don't go according to plan for them. Ultimately, a tool of inspiration to kind of keep you moving forward on the path to your goals. So what about that? Did we succeed there? I don't know. I've gotten some very nice emails over the years. I've talked to some very fine folks, friends, where that seems to have happened. It seems to have been that source of inspiration, a source of help for them. And I myself have been inspired after conversations. So maybe a success in that regard. Maybe the purpose of this podcast was a success. And maybe this is what I was trying to get at with like my horrible closed loop analogy last week. If you listen to that, like the finite versus the infinite, I think it's maybe more measurable versus immeasurable or quantitative versus qualitative. Like maybe this podcast failed on a quantitative scale, like my aims, but succeeded on a qualitative scale, like the purpose. And maybe the opposite holds true for many of us as well, right? Like sometimes we achieve the measurable thing that we set out to do, but then have this feeling of emptiness when we achieve it. We've heard it plenty of times on this podcast. So that then gets me to this final place of feeling like, I think there's a problem with trying to break down what is a success, what is a failure. Because in this one definition of failure, I have two outcomes here. And it's because there's nuance, right? Like, it's always been about nuance and your interpretation of those nuances. You know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Maybe you have trauma that you can't overcome. You need to fail to grow. I 100% agree to that. What about a heart attack, though? Does the heart come back stronger? What about a broken bone? Does the bone come back stronger? Maybe it's reinforced. Maybe not. Or maybe the human comes back stronger in the long run because they change their health habits or whatever. Hence why I talked about the importance of distance and perspective when it comes to dealing with failure. And we can nitpick all this shit until we're blue in the face. What I'm trying to conclude in a roundabout ass way is this. Humans, in general, I believe, do not like nuance. We see it all the time in arguments and politics because nuance leads to nowhere a lot of the time, to non-definitions, to the undefinable, not winning, throwing up your hands and saying, I don't know. Yeah, everything's real. Or everything's fake. I don't know. Because we just kind of want to know what helps us and hurts us. That's about it as humans, right? Pleasure or pain, fight or flight, baby. We don't want to be paralyzed by the many choices we find. We don't want to go down a rabbit hole of game theory. We don't have time for that. We want to know, and we want to fucking know now. Or give off the illusion that we know what we're doing, what we're talking about, so we know what tribe to run with, right? Because that's safe. Why? Because civilization and society and technology, all this shit has evolved at a much faster rate than Homo sapiens could ever keep up with, right? Species evolve over like millions of years. Human evolution happened over a couple million years as we transition from chimps, right? Which we share 99% of our friggin' DNA with, which is insane. Homo sapiens are like 200,000 years old. That's it. Civilization's only about 10,000-ish years old. So folks, man, we're running on old software. And we can't update it fast enough. There's bugs and malware that McAfee can't fix right now. And this is why empires keep falling and the same wants and desires and fears are present in humans throughout the centuries. Okay, Don, get to the point. I'm doing it right now. I think at its core, failure boils down to this primal, deep fear in our souls of being ostracized or isolated. And we can't update the software fast enough to override that shit. Okay, because it's an almost Pavlovian survival instinct at this point. being kicked out of your tribe meant danger, meant uncertainty, it meant fear, it meant death a lot of the times. We're a social species to the core, and I think that fear of being kicked out or isolated is like the hardest thing to override. I think that's why there's a fear of failure, but also a fear of success as well. Those are two sides of the same coin. Both can feel isolating, right? It's lonely at the top and it's lonely at the bottom. But that fear of failure is so strong because we think we are going to be seen as publicly defective, right? A broken toy. That's why we put up all these fronts and have this need to remind people that, hey, we're doing okay, baby. But secretly, man, we're hurting. We're hurting. It's amazing how egocentric we can get when we feel like we failed at something. That like shame, that embarrassment, it just feels so lonely. And we live in a society that rewards individual achievement, that has societal standards. So of course it feels like no one else is going through what you're going through when you don't achieve something. And even if people have been through it before, no one understands exactly how you feel in that moment. And so we run from that feeling. We have these hopes, we have these dreams, and we squash them. Anything to run away from that feeling of potentially being seen as defective, therefore of no use, therefore ultimately isolated, right? We got to start seeing failure for what it is. We got to accept it. We got to thank it for being useful at times. But you know what? We got to say, I'm tired of you debilitating me from living a goddamn full life. We have to learn how to update the software. So was this podcast a failure? Yes. No, I don't know. I can say I didn't hit certain numbers or financially it was not sustainable, but it also motivated me and it taught me plenty of things like the importance of consistency. It made me practice a craft. It made me talk deeply with friends and strangers. It made me think. It made me feel. And maybe it helped you folks feel a little less alone, made you feel connected, safe, not rejected, not broken, not isolated. If you want to live a full life, failure's inevitable. It just is. Failure's growth, the failure's nuanced, failure's a learning opportunity. Failure's a way to connect with society, not feel rejected from it. Failure is not an end unless you decide it is. And even then, it might not be a failure. Failure's whatever you make of it. You're in control of what you do with your failures. They're yours. They're no one else's. Own that shit. All right, I'm going to come off my high horse and end it with this because I'm sweating my ass off in my car. It's the only place I can record right now. I've taken a deep dive into philosophy lately, okay? That's a whole other podcast, but I highly recommend that you look up the Japanese philosophy of wabi-sabi, because I believe this podcast is very simpatico with the aesthetic of wabi-sabi. Wabi-sabi, in essence, is the acceptance of the transience and imperfection of life. There is beauty in the imperfect, impermanent, and incomplete. This aesthetic can be applied from, I don't know, teacups to landscapes, from people to maybe even podcasts. Okay. So I encourage you all to practice a little bit more wabi-sabi in your lives moving forward. The need to fail is no doubt imperfect, impermanent, and somewhat incomplete. And I, Don Finelli, am no doubt imperfect, impermanent, and incomplete. All right. Thanks for listening. Let's get to the show. Got my boy, Chris Gethard, man. Shit. He's a good friend, a teacher. He's my mentor. This is the third time I'm interviewing him for The Need to Fail. Initially interviewed him back in 2012 for my Need to Fail blog that I had on Tumblr. My first and only interview for that blog. I did another interview with Abby Nolan of Broad City. Then I got lost in my computer that crashed. That was really fun. But in that first interview, Geth talks about his SNL writing journey. There's some public panic attacks that he talks about. I then interviewed him again for this podcast back at the end of 2017, I think for episode 28. So now this is Geth in the middle of success. The Chris Gethard Show goes to cable. His off-Broadway show Career Suicide's running and eventually becomes an HBO special. He's starring in Mike Birbiglia's movie, Don't Think Twice. Beautiful Anonymous starts up. He's got another book deal. So he's riding pretty high in that interview. We also talk about, you know, failure, and he has very insightful, motivating things to say about that, no doubt. But now here we are almost 140 episodes later, and we're catching Chris in a kind of creative valley of sorts. Although he now lives in a very quaint house with his lovely wife and kid in New Jersey near a lake, which I made horrible big lake jokes to him, don't worry. And we really take a deep dive into what is success and what is failure and how we actually think, you know, what we've experienced kind of transcends both of those words. I couldn't think of a better way to close this thing out. And I actually had my greatest epiphany about my life choices during this conversation that you'll hear me talk about towards the end of the interview. It really shut the door on any doubts I had about the career choices I made up until this point. So I had the pleasure of visiting Geth and his family at his home on my stopover in Jersey recently. We were tested prior. We did the whole social distance thing, don't worry. But we had this really long conversation standing on the opposite ends of a floating dock in the middle of his lake, you know, watching our kids playing the shallows with our wives. And it was just lovely. And you'll hear us reference that. We also switched with our wives at one point. We're playing with our kids, and Geth could not stop talking about the Gurkhas, this Nepali Special Forces unit, which pretty much sums Geth up. You know, deep existential crisis combos right into sharing passionate Gurkha stories. genuinely love this dude. Check out Geth's podcast, Beautiful Anonymous, on Earwolf. He most recently crushes it in Netflix's Space Force alongside Steve Carell and John Malkovich. Still rocking out Chris Gethard Presents on Planet Scum on Wednesday nights. Hey, let's get to it. It's the final interview. It's with Chris Gethard.
Well, it's interesting because I've been thinking about coming back on.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild because we spoke in 2017, and you know, I think a lot, 2016 and 2017 were such crazy years for me. By far the most success I've had. And I mean, 2016 is when I feel, you know, when I feel like the dam really broke. Because the Gethard Show, Career Suicide, Don't Think Twice, that was all in the same year. And then I got that book deal all in the same year. That's crazy.
Felt like the pinnacle, like you worked up to that point.
Yeah,
you for had many, put in many so years. Much fucking work in,
I know.
At that point.
And then I had a, you know, the show got canceled and my book missed, and now I'm hosting a show on Twitch for 120 people and I like doing it, but it's definitely interesting. I tell you, Don, I have like, well, I have this dialogue. I have it in my head almost every day where I feel like, oh, I'm totally irrelevant now. I was just thinking today about how like there's comedians who I really like lately where I go, oh, they're doing the coolest shit. And then I realize they're probably like 26.
Yeah.
And then I go, well, of course I'm not as relevant as someone who's 26. And when I started doing comedy in New York, they were in first grade.
Yeah.
You know, and I have a lot of these young comedians like Sarah Squirm from Hell Trap Nightmare, someone who I think is great. She does such interesting stuff. And the first time we met, she like quietly leaned over and was like, I just want you to know I grew up in Long Island and I used to watch your public access show every week and I tried to intern for you guys. I was like, that's amazing. That's amazing to hear that and I've heard that a lot, that people were watching, especially the public access show, that a lot of young comedians watched it before they decided to go for it. I think that's cool, but I remember who the 40-year-old guys were when I was 20, you know? And I remember that I thought a lot of them were super funny. I don't know if I thought they were cool. And I'm there, and it's, I feel so much stress and anxiety about it. And then I tell myself, I feel like such a failure still. And then I go, I had an HBO special.
Yeah.
I had 47 episodes of my show on cable, over 200 when you count public access.
Yeah.
But 47 episodes on cable, even if we just say that. HBO special, 47 episodes of a show with my name on it on cable.
Yeah.
Bunch of TV shows, parts on
two books.
Three books. All before I was 40.
Yeah.
And I sit here and go, and you visited my new house. I never dreamed I would live in a house like this.
Yeah.
And then I'm still sitting here feeling these feelings of inadequacy. And then you and I were laughing at the beginning. It's like I have all this stuff and I have a beautiful son and wife. And I've done all these things and I'm proud of them. And yet about what, 3 weeks ago, a month ago, you and I were randomly doing a show together on Zoom. I forget
We were doing the George Lucas show.
Yes,
Fizzy Boys reunion show.
Yeah, and we were texting beforehand.
Yeah.
And it was kind of serendipitous because I mean, you are one of the people out of anyone I've met through comedy, you're one of the people who I remain closest to.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like every time I go to LA, you're really the first person mm-hmm. I make sure you know I'm coming.
Yep.
I feel like anytime you're on the East Coast, we find time. So you texted me that day of like, and it was literally like, oh, psyched to drink some soda again.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote back and was like, Don, I got to warn you. I'm having right now, all day today, I've been having a breakdown and was actually making arrangements to commit myself to a hospital. Yeah. And I wound up not doing it because my shrink got on the phone with me in the middle of the night. But like,
yeah, you were there.
I was right there. And then yeah. I think I was thinking about coming on this podcast and how you and I spoke about that. And I'm like, man, when it really doesn't go away. Like success doesn't solve failure, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, yeah. What are your questions?
That's such a good, like bust into like an intro song right there. Yeah. I was worried about you and yeah. I hadn't been in contact with you enough to know maybe you've been in that place before, but it feels like you haven't been in that place in a long time.
Years. And I would say a solid 8 years.
Yeah.
I would say a solid and 8 years since I felt that bad.
Yeah. I was worried about you and, just wanted to make sure you're okay. And,
yeah. And you checked in a few times, man. It was nice of you.
Of course. I mean, yeah, you're my friend, man. Like you were going through some shit and I think it's a beautiful thing that you said, like success doesn't solve failures.
It's not a one-to-one. It's not.
They're not equal.
No, it's not like a kid's toy where it's like there's a round hole and if you can find the peg that fits it, the hole is plugged.
Yeah.
It's not. That's the system's more complex than that, it turns out. And it's wild because I'm someone who spent... you know, I've spent 20 years in this and I can feel it winding down, at least in the form that it's been. I don't know what the future holds for the first time in my life. I'm going to be a creative person, but I don't know what. And it's very wild to think about it right now.
But I don't know if you did this or I dreamt it, but I feel like you posted something like recently where you were almost like, I think I'm like done with this stuff for a little while.
Dude.
And
yeah.
It felt like you were kind of like, I moved to New Jersey and I'm just going to kind of have this life. You also texted me. I don't know if you want me to say this, but like there's a farm nearby and I think I want to be a stock boy there.
Well, it's.
And I passed by that farm and dude, you should do it. I told you to do it before and then I saw the farm.
It's a beautiful farm. Like,
it's a beautiful farm.
What do you need? You need somebody to pick corn? Show me how. Well, yeah. Well, here's the thing is like when I was, 16 years old, my number one goal in life was to get an article published in Weird New Jersey magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And then I eventually co-wrote Weird New Jersey and Weird US of the books and wrote Weird New York.
Right.
That was when I was 24. Mm-hmm. I had written Weird New York by then.
Yeah.
I started at UCB. My goal was to get on a Herald team.
Mm-hmm.
7 years later, I was a guest writer at SNL. Mm-hmm. And all these years later, I've been on movies and TV. So, you know, I set out, I wanted to do a talk show. And my talk show was never huge or mainstream. It was what it was. And it was what I intended it to be. And I'm really proud of it. But it's like, let me fuck around and see if I can do a talk show at UCB. 47 episodes on cable with my name on it.
Yeah.
And I'm not even 40 at that point. So what I'm figuring out is like, I think I am someone who's been able to set goals that are very realistic. And mm-hmm. then what I'm finding is that maybe sometimes I have underestimated myself and exceeded mm-hmm. those goals sooner than I thought. But I'm also someone who really enjoys a dogfight of trying to make things happen.
Right.
But it's like, when I set out to do this, I wanted to do a few things and I wanted to do them my own way. And nobody can argue that I've done that exponentially larger than I should have been able to. And you know, I think a lot lately, and I'm not comparing myself to these people, but I'm like, you know, like, what the fuck happened to, like, Catherine Zeta-Jones? You haven't seen her in a movie in a while. She was really, really talented, brilliant. Where's she been? What's she doing right now? What do these people do when they're done? You know what I mean? I think that was a good example. Unless she's been doing all sorts of stuff I don't know about. But you know what I mean? You think about it. Like, there was a point when Molly Ringwald was the actor to play a young person. And then it was done. And she was probably 30.
Yeah.
You know, Winona Ryder, when she showed up in Stranger Things, there were all these think pieces of like, holy shit, Winona Ryder's back. Like, she's not retirement age.
Right.
We're working in this industry where you tend to like hustle for nothing, and then burn really bright, really fast for a short period of time. And then you're largely done. And I'm smart enough to know that.
Yeah.
And I've tried to pivot in a few other directions that haven't totally worked. And yeah, there's a farm near my new house, and they have a help wanted sign out front. And I've thought seriously about calling them and being like, what kind of help? I'll work two or three shifts a week. I'm lucky I have my podcast that pays the mortgage for now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, maybe I'll just work really hard on keeping that going and trying to keep that healthy. I work one day a week on it and then pick up some shifts at the farm. Or I got really into the idea of like, I'd love to work just the cash register at a comic book store. I love comic books.
Yeah.
I'm at that point where I'm like, maybe I should just do something like that for a few years and see what happens. But then I'm sitting here going, is this just low self-esteem? Am I underestimating myself again? I don't know.
I think the tough thing with all of this is relying on what you did in the past and your work ethic of the past and where opportunities led you. Like in the blog, you were telling me about SNL, right? And you were telling me about you worked there for 2 weeks and then you put in a packet thinking about, this is what they want to hear, right?
I got the inside track.
Yeah. So you figured out after all these years that you have to do it all yourself in a way. Like you have to surround your people, like-minded people, and you have to kind of like work in a vacuum, I think you said, and do your best work there and just kind of put the blinders on and like do what you think's fun. And I think you have to get to a point where maybe you do need other people's help, right? Like you got so used to doing it all yourself. And now you get to a point you're like, one, maybe tired.
Exhausted.
You know what
and,
I mean?
And a totally different person.
Yeah, right.
A completely different human being. I don't hate myself every day. I would never today go on public access television and bring a kickboxer, a professional kickboxer, legitimately a man who's had professional Muay Thai fights to beat the shit out of me on TV. I wouldn't do that today. Right, a different human being. And I'm exhausted.
Yeah. But that's what I'm saying. I think the DIY punk attitude gets to a point where you do get older, you get more tired, and your life changes enough where it's like maybe you just need to float a little bit in your fucking lake for a hot second and trust that maybe there will be another opportunity, or just take an exhale at a certain point.
Yeah.
And enjoy your present moment and just see what happens and not put the pressure on yourself to like, I got to create again until the instinct happens. That's also something that you taught me, which is like hitting that moment. You're like, I got to do something. Like I felt like you have your ebbs and flows of life. And maybe you realize this or don't realize this, where you have this instinct where you're like, now I need to create. And I think you're just at a bottom. Well, you're at the valley right now. Where you can, and also Beautiful Anonymous was kind of a side thing for you. You spent years doing a show with your fucking name on it. Then you do Beautiful Anonymous. Beautiful Anonymous becomes the thing that you're doing regularly that helps pay the fucking mortgage.
And that I never saw coming. And where the audience never saw coming. A comedy audience. Mm-hmm. Like I spent years earning this other audience of like college kids and freaks and punks with blue hair. And then all of a sudden Beautiful Anonymous is like in a really lovely way. I just had literally had a marketing meeting. 78% of my audience is females in their 30s and 40s. It's just not what I built over time. And I love it. I love it. I love it. And I love that I get to speak to them. And I actually feel so inspired that my whole thing for years was like, The system does not want to pay attention to anybody. You got to fight through everything. A lot of people are just feeling fucking shitty in the world. And I was speaking to a lot of like college punk type kids. And then it's like, oh, who feels that more in modern history than young moms? Who else feels like not listened to and fucking cast aside historically more than housewives? And they're rallying behind the same message I've kind of always had, just delivered in a different way.
Yeah. But it's also you can also look in deeper to the pathos that you bring to things. So you can have this external fight the system, chip on shoulder, you know, fuck the man, like let's do it ourselves thing. But at the bottom of it all is your willingness to be in a moment and be vulnerable. And I think that's attractive. So it's like, oh, I can't believe I did all this shit. And then Beautiful Anonymous is the thing that got me. But you are bringing what you've always done.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's there's just nothing. I think it's like that, the punk and whatnot, that shit's on the surface. What's behind it is who you truly are, which is like, I'm willing to open myself up and be vulnerable in front of people and maybe say some things that will either make you uncomfortable, make you feel something to your core, right? So that you're bringing the same thing. It just, maybe you were forcing it a little bit more in one area with the talk show, with the kind of creating a cadre of like-minded nut jobs and had that Howard Stern mentality, right? And thought, you're like, this is perfect for me. But at the core of that, right? Like,
well, you know what was, it's exactly,
that's why Howard Stern does such fucking good interviews.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's what's behind all of that shit. And of course he evolved.
Well, it's always been, I don't care if it's like, we're going to throw baloney at Hank, the angry drunken dwarf. If you're a real fan of Howard Stern, what you like is like, oh, Robin went off on Baba Booey today. That's what brings you back way more than the stunts ever did. And now there's less and less of that stuff. And you're still just have, oh, this is like a family on the radio. But you know what?
Right.
You know what really rings true about what you're saying is like, in one sense, my TV show failed.
Mm-hmm.
It crapped out. But nothing goes forever. And 47 episodes, a lot more than most shows get. But in another sense, I think back to it and it's like, I was 29 when I started the Chris Gethard show.
Yeah.
And I think I was 38 when it died.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we did it for 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle of that, 2016, 2 years before the show goes away, Beautiful Anonymous hits. And like you said, it's the same thing at the core. But what was very hard for me to realize in the moment and for me to accept was like, yes, you're the same person. And yes, you have the same mentality and the same goals. When you're 29, 25-year-olds are going to look at you and go, fuck yeah, that guy's the guy leading the charge for people like me. When you're 36, it's going to be a different group of people. And you can't be one thing forever. You shouldn't want to be.
Did you have a trouble getting to that point, though? You know what I mean? Did you realize that in the moment? Or was that like, I'm looking back now, I'm like, oh yeah, I was trying to appeal to young 20-somethings.
Well, yeah, it was just sort of like, once we got to cable, like up until we got on cable, the show could evolve and be whatever it wanted to be. UCB, it was one thing. Public Access, it went through many different iterations. Here's what we're focused on now. Some of it's the more fucking violent stuff. Some of it's more stunt-driven stuff. Some of it's the emotional stuff. Cable, it's like, it is what it is. It's locked in now what it is. It can't evolve anymore. And I was still evolving. So the Gethard Show, I mean, you were there for the formative parts of it, deep into it. And it was the most important thing to me in the world.
Yeah.
It was this thing that all of a sudden we captured lightning in a bottle and it was like, yeah, this is how my brain's always worked.
Yeah.
And I've always been good at improv. But I've always had this other side of myself that was a little more fucked up and angry. And this show is now it's capturing it and people are actually fucking responding. And now it's on public, it's unfolding nationally. So it's like, and then along the way, the people who are coming to do it, starting with you, Will and Shannon and Bethany. And then along the way, we get Murph, we get Bluff Ben, and it keeps unfolding and fucking, you know, the more professional, you know, Public Access, I'm the first person to put Connor O'Malley on TV. Public Access, but it counts. Joe Pera, I believe. I'm not certain on that. Like right. all these people you see doing shit. You can go back and look at the show. And then we get to a point where I can actually hire people. I believe I gave Joe Firestone her first writing job, Julio Torres his second, Anna Fabrique. Like all these people I'm so proud I worked with down the line. I mean, I could just list more and more. And I'm not saying right. that to brag, and I'm not saying that to take any credit for them, but I'm saying it really was like this tidal wave where I felt like I was a person who did not feel like a natural fit in the world I was dwelling in. And then all of a sudden I started basically shouting that to the Hilltops, and all the other people felt that way flocked to it.
Yeah.
It went
right,
on for years.
Right.
So yeah, walking away from that and feeling like you are home for the first time is hard. Yeah. Cause the Gethard show was a safety net for me and an umbrella where I felt accepted and safe. I was building this thing where all these other people felt accepted and safe. And that's one of the things people loved about it, but they never totally understood like, oh, I need it probably as much or more than any of you, you know? Mm-hmm. And so right. leaving that nest, it was definitely a comfortable nest, but it's also like, how much longer am I going to trap myself in a cage and have 100 pounds of human hair fall on me? That's one of the things we did in one of our late era episodes on True TV. And I'm like, it's really funny, but if this show was still allowed to evolve, I'd be making it more conversational. There'd be less mayhem. The color scheme even. I remember thinking like the color schemes, like all these bright neon-y color, it would be more subdued. And then you think about what I'm describing. I'm like, oh, it's Beautiful Anonymous is that. Beautiful Anonymous is something that's way more, it takes all the stuff I still loved about it, but it's relaxed yeah. and subdued. So, but it's hard, man. I guess at the end of the day, it's hard to grow up. And it's hard to realize, oh, I built this bubble to keep people like me safe. But I'm not one of those people anymore.
You also stopped feeling safe in that bubble, I think.
I think, it felt very forced in that bubble. But
yeah,
I'm like,
right.
I remember Mandzukas pulled me aside one year at the Del Close Marathon. He's like, and Mandzukas has always had my back hard. He's like, I just want to put it out there, dude. The underdog thing isn't going to work too much longer.
Mm.
And I was like, but that's always how I still fucking feel it. He's like, it doesn't matter if you feel it. Because people understand now that you're making money off what you do. And mm-hmm. also you married your band leader and she's pretty fucking hot, man. Like, I don't know if anybody's going to look at you and go, man, that guy's a real underdog. And it proved really true. And I've had to learn to drop the underdog thing. But then here's another question I've done is how, I think here's where my real struggle is. And you're helping bring it to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I know I'm not an underdog. People loved Career Suicide and hearing that I was like this depressed guy who had to keep taking his lumps and getting back up. And mm-hmm. I'm not that guy anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't want to pretend that I don't feel really scared a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel like I have to bite my tongue about that or apologize for it.
But don't you feel like you can be an underdog in your personal life and not have it be public? Meaning, can't you feel like the underdog all the time? And if that drives you, if that's your like yeah. motivating factor and that gets you angry and active.
But my work has always been about being profoundly honest.
Yeah, right.
And being profoundly honest now does inherently entail trying to explain that I feel so fucking great about my life. And it turned out in a way that's like a miracle compared to where I thought I'd be fucking yeah. dead by 40. Are you kidding? I bet you probably did too at certain points, you know?
Most I'm going to be honest. Friends, I think so. Yeah. There were some scary points. Sure.
Yeah. I turned out great. My kid rules. I live in a good house mm-hmm. in a nice night, way nicer section in New Jersey than I grew up in. Like, but how do I wear my heart on my sleeve and have anything interesting to say? And then I have these moments where I go, maybe I don't have anything interesting to say. And then sometimes that fills me with panic. And then sometimes it feels like the sweetest release.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
right.
oh, I went and did it all and I won. I set out to do these things where I thought I was going to lose, but yeah. I won.
Right.
And I met all
you
these
said
people
you were losing
along
the way too.
And I did. We just kept kind of losing and but owning it. And then it turned out, but it's really true. How yeah. many times did fucking people say they were going to buy the Gethard show and then not? Yeah. I mean, behind the scenes, it happens so often. And then it kept just working.
But this is what it comes down to, though. Like, what is success? What is failure, right? You could have looked at all those things as minor failures, and you can come out of it, you know, like fucking BoJack Horseman sitting on his little, in his pool. You know what I mean? Just floating around being Jesus.
I'll tell you, can I give one piece of advice about what is success and what is failure? And here's another thing, a sensitive
You can give more than one.
Well, because here's another thing that you and I talked about during our recent visit. And we were
standing on a dock.
You know exactly what I'm about to say.
We think found so. It,
and the dock was wide enough that we could socially distance. You were in
That's
one
right.
corner, I was the other. We were the only two people on it at the time. Mm-hmm. But here's where I fucked up. Because I went to war. And if anybody who's close to me, anybody who ever worked with me, and you didn't need to even be that close with me. If you came out of New York when all this shit was forming, people knew I'm a real nice guy and I'm pretty mild mannered, but ask anybody who ever took an improv class with me. Mm-hmm. I was going to war with the fuck, anything that felt like the powers that be, starting at UCB's powers that be, the entertainment industry. I didn't like it. I still don't like it. I think it exploits artists. I think it doesn't reward the best stuff. And I think there's a lot of people who make a lot of money being professional middlemen that are leeches on artists. I felt that stuff so strongly. I still do.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I fought this fucking war for years.
Yeah. You were saying this for a very long time, probably since I met you.
A lot of
not only about like the UCB system as a whole, but like
the entertainment industry,
the entertainment
and the fucking world and the world, man.
Right.
I've known since a young age that fucking being a good person doesn't keep you fucking ahead in this world. I saw that from day one where I grew up, the way I grew up. I saw it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was angry from the fucking start, man, and terrified from the start.
Yeah.
And here's the thing is like, I have people in my life tell me, like, you know, you did all that shit before you're 40. You're really successful at it, man. Mm-hmm. And I can intellectually step back and say, yeah, objectively, I met with more success than I thought I ever would, probably more than I deserved, you know? But here's the thing. Here's the advice I'll give along the way. What is success? What is failure? Well, you and I started talking as part of this project when I had very little success and a lot of stress. And then we talked in the middle of the success. Mm-hmm. And now we're post-success.
Probably at the height of it, yeah.
Yeah, really right at the height of it. As I was processing that, all of a sudden having money, you know, real money and figuring out how do I fucking make this last my whole life, you know, like what can I do? Real success. And now I'm on the other side of it. And here's where I fucked up, man, is I convinced myself that the other people in the trenches fighting that war were my friends. Mm-hmm. And I undervalued the word friend and what it means. Mm-hmm. Because, and I'm not trying, this is an analogy. Being a comedian is not fucking hard, okay? I'm not a real soldier in a real war. I understand that, right? The whole dialogue that comedy is so fucking hard, it's a challenging industry, but we're not fucking coal miners.
Yeah. It's a challenging industry even if you have talent.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's a crapshoot. Mm-hmm. The most talented people in the world still have to stress.
2 + 2 doesn't equal 4. It's a mind fuck sometimes.
Yep. At the end of the day, though, we're all blessed that we even get to try. And I know that. But to continue the analogy, now that I've laid out that I'm respectful that it's not a real war, no platoon gets home and then wants to fucking hang out with each other again. You know what I mean? Those Band of Brothers guys had reunions, what, like 40 years later or whatever. I don't know for sure, but I read the book and loved the show. Sorry, Connor. Sorry, Connor Rabbit. I fucking love Band of Brothers. But you know what I mean? Everybody's left with their own experience, their own scar tissue, and they go in different directions. And a lot of love. Bethany Hall and Keith Haskell are on their way to my house right now to visit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Two people who I love. They live 20 minutes away. We're still going to see each other. You and I still connect. Mm-hmm. People who have followed my work and who understood that I viewed it so much as a family environment would be, and I'm not going to name names because it would be disrespectful, they'd be shocked at the people who I never hear from.
Right.
Even who I've reached out to. Mm-hmm. And they'd be shocked at the people who once the experience was over, mm-hmm. started treating me in a way that was a little mean, even in one person's case. And again, not naming names, and I worked with everyone. You can't watch the show and guess, because I worked with fucking hundreds of people over the years. But
it makes you emotional, though, thinking about it. I can see it.
It does.
Yeah.
Because I convinced myself that creative allies are friends. And that's the advice I give to anybody. Because I'm proud of my success, and I know I'm successful. And I was your first blog interview, and this is the last podcast?
This is it, man. This is the final one.
So I get that it's full circle, and it's like, yeah, I fought. You can track the whole thing through Don's podcast, and you can hear where I was at. And the success happened, and I'm fucking psyched that the success happened. But I think the reason that I'm on the other side of it and still having these feelings of like, I checked every box that I wanted to check. Why do I still not feel satisfied? Why am I still feeling this anxiety? It's because I mistook creative allies as friends, and they're different things.
Yeah. And meaning you don't have the meaningful relationships you thought you had were based on something else.
I always had it in my mind of there's all these people who think I can't succeed and I'm going to prove them wrong. And I did prove them wrong. Mm-hmm. And here's two things I learned along the way. There weren't that many of those people. And I may have mentioned
this. A lot less people than you think.
I may have mentioned this in one of our previous conversations, because I realized this a few years ago, but it's like this whole like I'm going to prove them wrong. It's not really them. And then word gets back to me, like the childhood bullies from my neighborhood who I still hate. Like word got back to me. There's one guy who I legitimately, if he walked in front of my car, I'd hit the gas. I hate this person. And I don't say that about many people. And then word got back to me that a friend of mine who still lives in our hometown was in a bar. And this was many, many years ago. An episode of Conan popped up and I was doing a bit on Conan. So this was fucking 18, 17 years ago. And the kid was like, that's our fucking boy from the hood, man. That's our boy from the block. I'm like, oh, so the guys I hate are just taking like small amounts of quiet pride in me. Those are the people I'm there proving wrong. But it's like, I was fighting this war in my mind, and I went out and I did prove them all wrong. And I won at all the things I wanted to do. And now I go, well, who fucking cares? Because I got no friends. And that's what you and I were talking about on the dock. Because I was telling you some of these people's names, and I think you would agree with me. People who watched my work over the years and perceived these as familial bonds would be shocked at how some of these things have gone. One or two in particular. And it's thrown me for a real loop.
Well, what's your advice on then what would you have done differently?
Here's what I would have done differently. If you're a creative person, we all know. You 100% do unquestionably have to go all in. You're not going to make it. Mm-hmm. If the next person over is working harder than you are, they deserve it more. Mm-hmm. So by all means, go all in. But like your friends in high school who are insurance salesmen, or your ex-girlfriend from college who's a really good person who has a couple kids now, and it was an amicable breakup, and you're just psyched that you're still in each other's lives. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, your cousin who's around your same age. Touch base with them.
Yeah.
I didn't do that enough. And now I'm kind of left with a very, very happy life and a very real sense of accomplishment at the age of 40, wondering what the fuck to do with the rest of my life. And also wishing that I had shared it with more people along the way. And also don't fuck up the friendships you have, man. Because I want to also be clear. I'm sitting here going, some of these people walked away from me, but I've done it to other people. I've done it to other people. I'm an idiot. Yeah. I want to say admittedly that I'm a fucking idiot with bad social graces. And I was a fucking weirdo growing up. And I've always been uncomfortable socially. And because of that, like, I got friends who, when they had kids, I didn't buy them gifts. And we're not friends anymore. And now I have a kid and I'm like, oh, that's why we're not friends. I've always wondered why this person, why we're not as close as we used to be. Well, yeah.
I think it's less about the gifts and more about the interest in their kids, probably.
It's in the interest in the life development. It's in the interest in we're evolving people and I'm rooting for you along the way.
Yeah.
And a lot of us who are creative go, my goals get before everything else. And what I would say is that there is a happy medium where you can do that. And I think many of my favorite people who I know in entertainment do this already. But I think there's also a ton of people like me where it's just like, I'm a good guy and we're fucking pals, but you don't understand, man. Everybody's fucking doubting me. So I got to go. There's a friend of mine who I skipped his wedding to go do the Just for Laughs Festival. Now, the Just for Laughs Festival, very important festival to many comedians. Do I regret skipping his wedding? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing came out of the Just for Laughs Festival for me. I missed my friend's wedding and we're not tight anymore. It sucks. Good friend of mine.
Yeah.
And I've apologized to him and he's been like, ah, dude, shit happens. And he's like, I'll always have your back and I know you'll always have my back. But yeah, we used to hang out 3 times a week when you lived in
New York. This though. I bet you if something even did come out of that Just for Laughs, you might still feel the same way you do in a macro sense of where you are right now.
Well, it's the thing you can't perceive when you're in it, right? Because if I had skipped that Just for Laughs, I'd be sitting here forever wondering, would I have gotten a fucking sitcom deal? Would I have poached by some high-level agent? I'd be wondering forever. But now I'm on the other side of the success. So I can kind of report back and say, it didn't matter. It's your friend.
Yeah.
It's your really good friend. You hang out 3 times a week. You go to his wedding.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there going, he's a comedian too, and he'll get it. And he did. But also that's the end of something. And that's on me.
Yeah.
And I've done that to people, and I've now had people do that to me. And I have the extra added head trip of going, it's hard not to be a little paranoid and think that I was in a position where I funded a little economy. 70, 80 people had jobs through me for years with my cable show.
Right.
Most of them, I think, are people who are very appreciative of that. And then some of the people want nothing to do with me now when I thought we were going to be tight forever. And it's like, you know, hard not to be paranoid and go, ah, oh, I don't have money to hand out anymore. Is that why we were friends? Yeah. I don't know. I don't want to assume the worst of people. But then I sit there and go, is it something about me? Is it something about me?
But we've always said behind the scenes that, you know, listen, I'll say it again. I'll say every fucking episode that UCB, you're finding your people. That's where you're finding your collaborators. It technically brought us our wife, you know, like our
big time.
That's where I met my wife. You know what I mean? Like we have a kid because of UCB, but we also said on the dark side of it is like, you don't totally know who to trust. You're kind of all in this thing together and you're all using each other at a certain point. Right. And it's hard to know who you get close with. And especially you can go the distance with some folks and still come out of it and go like, wow, I didn't really know you, you know? And
yeah.
It's there's such good about it and there's such, you know, not good about it. And that's a mind fuck, especially a place, an institution that you kind of love so much. You see all the faults of it as well. But the people sometimes, like, that's just kind of how it is. Like, sometimes people just use other people. And we've done it too. You know what I mean?
I've done it too. And I don't think it's malicious in the moment.
No, exactly. That's the thing. I think it's the culture of what it is. I think it's the culture of being in a creative community.
Yes.
Because you're all being like, who's doing it? What's want to do? You want to do it? Who's working hard? Let's stay up till 2.
Who's like, setting the bar? Can I meet the bar? Can I set it higher?
Mm-hmm.
But you get there and now, you know, I'm back in Jersey now, dude. And I'll tell you, I'm like reaching out to some old friends.
Yeah.
And I'm saying like, hey, I'm back in Jersey. Let's meet up. Let's go get a, you know, let's go get a meal together. Come by my house.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here realizing when I started this, I was 19.
Yeah.
And I was still in touch with all these people. And in my perception, the whole time, I'm sitting here going, this is for them. Mm-hmm. This is for me and my friends in high school who were the fucking, like, weirdos in my friend Carson's basement because his parents let us have a drum set down there. We'd hang out all night. We'd listen to records. This is for me and my brother who fucking spent our whole childhoods fucking dodging bullies and like really getting our asses whipped sometimes. You know what I mean? Like, this is for my friends in college who we all lived together, and they were all like really funny, creative people who said, "Nah, we got to get real jobs." Like, I'm out here trying to represent all the people I knew on the way up who felt pushed around and held down like I have. And on some level, that was the fucking war I was fighting. And like I said, I won the war. But now I'm reaching out to these people and I'm realizing, oh, but from their perspective, they're like, I haven't really heard from you that much in 15 years.
Yeah.
And I've been like happily managing a restaurant for 11 years. And I let all that shit go. And I got a, dog and a girlfriend now. And we're like, we go really into camping and stuff. Like, I haven't been thinking about this whole time. You've been thinking about this whole time.
Yeah.
So I mean, I guess they're cliches, right? When you feel like you get to the top of where you're going to go. I certainly didn't hit the top of the entertainment industry, but as far as how I was
checking off boxes though.
Yeah.
You checked off a lot of boxes.
And look, as far as someone who said, I'm never going to move to LA, I'm never going to do pilot season, and I will demonstrate active distaste for people in the entertainment industry, even while pitching to them. I think I reached the top of that mountain. I set the mountain pretty low, but it's like lonely at the top, you know? And then as far as the people who I worked with, I'm on the way down now, right? And how do they treat you on the way up versus how they treat you on the way down? And I see the people who never gave a shit, where it was just a special thing for us to all be in it together.
Yeah.
I can see it and feel it. And then some of the others, I feel like, oh, I wonder if I'm ever going to hear from you again. And I'm shocked by that. But I've done it too.
Is this a different level of, I guess, failure? What you've never wavered on is your advice on getting used to failure. Like, the only way to succeed is to understand that it's there, that it's going to happen, and get comfortable with it. Are you taking your own advice at all at this point? Like, do you feel like you've failed in that regard? And is it a different, You know what I mean? Is it a different failure in a way, or?
Well, it's, here's the thing, is this is the third time we've talked, and this is the first one that's ever actually an analysis of success. I don't think we're talking about failure right now.
Right.
I think we're talking about the scar tissue and the consequences of success.
Yeah. Right.
And I think I did a lot of things the right way, but I think I did a lot of things the wrong way. And I think on the final episode of your podcast is actually maybe interesting for people to hear, like, do whatever you got to do, do whatever it takes, but it's on you to make sure you don't cut and run from your own foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we were talking about this, me and you are standing on a floating dock, and I'm like, Don, I have no friends. I'm like, I have no friends. You're one of the only actual friends of mine who's come to visit me at this house. You live 3,000 miles away. There's people who I know have cars and live within an hour, and I text them and they brush me off. I have no friends. And then, like I said, I was telling you, I was leaning on you going, well, this person sent me this fucking email. It was nuts. Yeah. This person, I thought we were going to fucking do this and that and this together, and I literally can't get them to answer texts, you know? Like,
yeah.
And you would agree, I think, of like, oh, well, yeah, that'll fuck your head up. Like, those are people you're really close with. But
sure,
that's on me. It's on me. And then you're
it is there. A two-way street, sure.
It is. And then I remember I said to you, I was like, does that happen to you? Where, like, you know, your friends are your friends while you're working with them, and then they're not your friends anymore. And you were like, well, no, because I got these like five or six buddies from high school, and we've always stayed in touch and leaned on each other. And I'm like, oh, I fucked up. I fucked up.
But that's not totally true though, because I did the same thing with you did. I just checked in with them maybe and were like, do you understand what I'm doing? Meaning, I'm not talking to you as much, and I'm not checking in with you as much, and I'm not thinking about you as much, and I'm not caring about you as much. How do you feel about that? I don't think I've ever said that specifically to them. I probably said it in a North Jersey bro way, but at its core, that's what it is. And there was 3-year period. I mean, I have regrets about not seeing my grandfather before he died because I was at a fucking improv practice. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
What's worth it, what's not worth it, I'm not sure. But I think the relationship thing, I also was almost, I almost pushed you off the dock in the middle of this.
It would have
I thought
been,
it would have been so that you were thinking funny. Oh, you were like, going, you were opening up, you were just, and you were just standing right by the edge. And I was like, I just want to, I'm listening to you.
It would have been the
had
best.
That, I had that Don instinct that was like, this would be way funnier though. But I didn't do it. But that is my big regret out of this whole podcast.
You know what else I'm realizing as you and I talk is like, I think, and again, not always, because you have a lot of fucking stories that I've heard that reflect a stretch of actual madness.
Yeah.
I think overall, it might be fair to say that when, although I don't know if that's true, because when you showed up at UCB, it was because your life, you had, it had been a real fucking disaster.
Yeah. Yeah. I was still doing cocaine at that point.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Not regularly, but I would still snort stuff. Yeah.
I don't think you've ever really told me you did a lot of cocaine.
I don't think I did a lot of it. I think I just did it socially because I was fucking miserable with my life. And as you said, you know, you were angry and terrified. I go like, yeah, anger is from being terrified.
Always.
Always. You know what I mean? But, and I was terrified, but I was didn't want to admit that. So I was just trying to escape it in every way I could. And I was totally lost. I was completely lost.
I feel like I have, as we talk, I realize I have a friend from college named Egyptian Mike. Great dude. Great dude. Life of the fucking party and always wanted to include everybody. Lived across the hall from me freshman year. And he reached out to me. He and I have always stayed in touch to a degree, comes and goes. And he and I were talking. One of our stretches, we were catching up and he goes, I always wanted to ask you, man, like, over the years, like I would get people from our hall back together and I'd reach out to you and try to include you. And you always just kind of brushed it off. And he's like, I just never understood why you wouldn't let me. And I remember doing some soul searching on it. I said to him, you know, I think when I started doing comedy, I didn't realize it then, but it was an eject button because my my life was getting scary. I mean, I was sitting around dwelling on suicide on a nightly basis for some stretches. So I think when I found it, it was like, I got to get the fuck out. And I said to him, you're the best. You've been a great friend to me. And I have kept you at arm's length, but I think there's a part of me that needs to own up to the fact that I abandoned ship on anything that made me feel that way. And
yep.
The work helped fill that hole.
Yep.
But
exactly.
I think maybe you were a little luckier in that you had some friends who weren't going to quit on you during that stretch. And maybe, I don't know if this is true. Did you allow yourself to lean on them a little bit more? Did you, in your truly miserable stretch?
No way. I just escaped, man. I went through the same thing because it was like, I almost had this complex of like, I'm broken, so I'm going to go get fixed. And then when I come back, I'll be better to my friends. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I felt like a broken fucking toy and a shell of a man. And I was putting on this bullshit persona and I felt fake. And then UCB, I kind of found something and I found a home and it felt right for the first time in my life. So I almost was like, oh, great, I'm going to get better. And maybe it's just a little less version of what you did. But yeah, I would check in with my friends every now and then. I'd still go to parties with them. But I was like, wait, I found something I loved. I'm just going to dive in every fucking week. And now I'm going to do 3 shows. And I'm going to be up till 1, 2 a.m. So I might not be able to check in with them or see how their girlfriend's doing or see that tough thing that they're going through. Or I just kind of was like, I'll be right back, guys. You know, I'm going to be back. I'm going to go work out. And when I come back, I'm going to be strong and I can fight off all our stuff and I'll be better. Yeah. I'm going to be a better person for you.
And you guys and are going to be so proud of me.
You're going to be so proud of me. I'm doing this for you, which is also kind of bullshit.
Yes. This
because you're doing it for yourself. Yeah. It's your justification. You kind of what you were saying about before. Like, oh, I'm, you know, for all these people, all my friends, all my friends, I'm doing this kind of, it's bullshit though. It's complete bullshit. I was doing it for myself. It was an excuse, but there was a true part of me that was feeling that what I'm saying is very honest of like, I felt broken. I felt like I found a place that could make me better, and I could, I just told them to hold on a second and I'll be better. But that's all bullshit. It's all bullshit, because what makes you better is other people, right? Like,
yeah.
I think finding your love, and I think we got to stop and go, finding your love and your passion and your joy and learning to work as hard as you can in it is very true. I was just talking to Josh Patton about this, about filling up your buckets. He took it from the David Sedaris thing, but like, my buckets were way full up. Like, I found something I love, I'm going full blast into it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then there's collateral damage of relationships, yeah. Family, friends. It happens. But you're saying, hey, I went through it all, and you know what matters a lot are those fucking relationships,
yeah.
Where people know you
absolutely.
At your worst and stick with you at your worst.
Because I tell you, I mean, this podcast is all about exploring these types of things. And I want to be clear. Mm-hmm. I got a great life.
Yeah, you said it, man. We know. Yeah.
I enjoy it every day.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I'm telling you, Don, I just watched out the window. My wife left our house pulling our one-year-old son down the street in a little red wagon. Like, I got the best life. I got this beautiful house. You know, the other day I mowed the lawn. And I turn around and I look at it. And I'm like, man, I got a fucking beautiful lawn. And then I take a breath and I think to myself, and that's it. I got a beautiful lawn.
Yeah.
And I earned this lawn.
Yeah.
I wish I had a few more people in my life to invite to come over and play wiffle ball on the lawn, you know? Yeah. I wish I hadn't. Because here's the other thing. Because you didn't say this on the doc, but here's my gut instinct. Is that you and I have remained as close as we are because you see me for what I am a little better than other people. And I think you know how to navigate it. And I think that you've made it a priority in a way that has reminded me to make it a priority. But I feel mm-hmm. like when I'm sitting here going, I have no friends, that you're probably on that doc going like, yeah. Yeah, I can see that, man. You fucking have acted like a fucking driven maniac for. Yeah, I get it. It surprised me though, but I don't think it surprised you.
No.
Yeah,
it's not like I'm not saying that I'm not surprised that you don't have friends, Chris, because of who you are. It's not that. It's I can understand because I went through something similar on a maybe lower scale. About dedicating your life and thinking that this was the thing that would make you happy because it did. You know what I mean? Because let's be honest, it did make you happy. It did feed your ego. It did make you feel powerful when you didn't feel powerful as a kid. It did make you a superhero a little bit when you were fucking reading X-Men as a kid and you wanted to be fucking multiple man, dude. Like, it did make you feel those things. You did feel the power. You did feel all that stuff. So I get that. There's just collateral damage when you put your fucking heart into something and something's gotta be sacrificed at times. And I think the older you get, the more you learn to balance those things and go, oh fuck, I had to go through all that stuff. This is not a advice fucking show where we go, so those going through it, you know, make sure that, you know what? Like, everyone has their own path, but maybe someone's listening and is going to reach out to their friend they haven't talked to in a while.
I think it's really important, man. And to keep those from the start, maintain those relationships, even on a casual level with the people who don't give a fuck about you and your creativity, but they have your back. Maintain those because what you just said was so wise. Cause I'm sitting here going, you're right. I did feel all those things as they were happening, but it's like I was chewing food just because it tasted good. It didn't mm-hmm. necessarily make me feel full. Mm-hmm. You know? So what am I going to do? Just keep shoving fucking food into my face forever? No, at some point I got to fucking slow down. I'm 40 years old. Like, people don't really give too much of a fuck anymore. They might again when I figure out what I have to say and who I have to say it to.
Mm-hmm.
I spent my whole life talking to the fucking kids with piercings and, you know, they don't give a shit anymore. There's other, like Sarah Squirm, who I mentioned, was great. She speaks to them so much more than I do. And they should. And she should. She's fucking great.
Yeah.
I got to figure out what's next or if anything's next. Maybe.
Well, yeah, that's what I was saying. Like, you're at that bottom, though. That's what I'm saying. Like, enjoy what you have now. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm not trying to give you advice, but it's like, when you see your lawn, don't think about the people that are not on the lawn. Just appreciate the lawn for a fuck's sake. Even though I made fun of your mulching when I got there, it was actually good. I knew that would just fuck with you, though.
Dude, I also, I fucked up my lawn so bad.
Of course you did.
I destroyed it completely. It's humiliating. It's humiliating, dude.
Perfect.
I was like, I'm tired of cutting it so often. I'm going to cut it really short so I don't have to cut it
that
often.
No, you don't do that.
I'm telling you.
Is it dead?
You saw it. It's a pretty big lawn. It's not huge.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lawn.
No,
it's a good sized lawn.
And when you saw it, it was grass.
Yeah.
It's 100% crabgrass now. Yeah. Overrun by weeds. I killed it.
Yeah, you can't do that, man.
I went to the like the plant nursery. And they told me there's nothing I can do about it until September. Like, so I just have to have the shittiest lawn in human history with all my new neighbors.
Well, we didn't talk about, like, when I interviewed you, man, like, you were at the top. Then the show kind of goes away. Your book doesn't do as well as you want it to. It's just like, you know, now you can look back. And I think, like, your Beautiful Anonymous was kind of buoying you through that. I don't know if it was, but it's like, it's so hard. You have such an interesting life. I think your work ethic, so all right, you have collateral damage here, but your work ethic also made you a living, meaning you put everything out there. You worked as hard as you could on things. You checked off these boxes, and what is left is kind of an amalgamation and this kind of derivative core of who you are, right? Like, in this podcast, like, out of all of this shit, this is what you're left with. So maybe you have a perspective on that, but I don't know. You know what it was like. There seemed to be like a fallout with all that stuff, with the book, with the show. You seem to not be. I think that's when the friendship stuff started. Like, who's my real friends? Like, and then the self hatred probably comes into that.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been well. There. But dude, the book is such an interesting thing.
Yeah,
because I think that book Missing So Hard.
Was it Lose Well?
Yeah,
that missed really hard for you.
Yeah, it didn't. It didn't sell.
Which seemed to be the most, like, a very vulnerable book.
Well, here's the honest truth. And nobody knows this story, and I can't go into the details, but that book, they wanted me to finish. They hired me to write it when Beautiful Anonymous, Birbiglia's movie, the TV show was popping off.
Yeah.
So we want you to finish this book before the season's done so we can get it out.
Right.
So if the show does get canceled, we can still float on all the press the show got.
Yeah.
And they were a self-help company. And I was like, I can't write a book while this show is happening. I don't want to really write a self-help book.
Yeah.
But they were offering me a sizable amount of money. And you know me well enough to know that it's not bullshit. Like, I've turned down money a bunch of times. Like, money
and jobs.
It's true. Like, money's not been the determining factor for me ever.
Mm-hmm.
But there was... And I can't go into it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. You might actually know a little of what I'm referring to, but there was some shit. There was some medical shit happening in my life
mm-hmm.
that I could not pay for.
Right.
And I said, for the first time in my life, I'm going to accept money for something that I don't totally believe in. And maybe I can convince myself to believe in it along the way. Maybe I can find the angle. But then I was on a clock, had to get it done. And I think I got it like 85 to 90% of where it needed to be. But that 10 to 15% felt, I think, like a lot of the people who had followed me forever, I think felt like, all right, the TV show's done and this book's not totally for me. And I don't regret it because it was a choice I really had to make. But I don't think it's a coincidence that the first time that I accepted money for something that I didn't fully believe in is when the momentum slipped, the hardest it's ever slipped. It's not a coincidence.
Sure. Yeah, but it helped success in a different area of your life.
Absolutely. And I was dealing with stuff that was extraordinarily traumatic mm-hmm. and that I needed the money to do it. So it was, in many ways, it felt like an actual gift from God. Mm-hmm. Not to be dramatic, but I mean, you know where my life was at. Like,
yep.
It's totally true.
I knew where totally you were true. With this. And I totally, like, when you were saying this, I was like, oh, yeah. So the product wasn't a failure. Like, it's such a funny thing. This always goes back to, like, what the fuck is success? What the fuck is failure?
Yeah,
man? Like, what are these words? These words are almost just made up. They're interchangeable at times, which is like, oh, you did something. It's like easy to step back and be like, yeah, of course that didn't work out. Of course that didn't work out for you, man. You didn't do the your heart wasn't in the place where the things were that were successful for you were. But on the other side of it, it was extremely helpful and almost gave you a different, you know, like it enlightened a different part of your life in a way, right?
Well, like it's wild. I mean, if the people who followed me over the years had any idea what was going on in my personal life on a very actual, real, and serious level, the entire 3 years we were on cable.
Yeah.
It was almost impossible to care as much about the work as I would have because there were a lot of scary things to deal with outside of that. And I'm not making excuses, but again, it's just another example of,
no, I could fully support what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. It was a fucking hard, hard ass time that no one knew about.
No one knew about it, and people still don't. But it ties back to what you're saying in the beginning of, like, this show was the tail end of my childhood, and I'm clearly in adulthood.
Yeah.
And the situations I was dealing with couldn't be more,
more
related to adulthood, and it was just like, man, stuff feels like it's finally withering away. And
now we're fucking fathers, man.
Well, and I was just gonna say, dude, isn't that it? Isn't that the last final fucking thought at the end of the day? Is like,
yep,
I proved everything I wanted to prove. I worked with some fucking brilliant comedians, musicians, artists along the way, filmmakers. I represented some shit to a lot of people in a way I'm proud of. I've had people tell me that stuff I did 10 years ago helped them pull the trigger and go for it themselves. I'm immensely proud of that. I supported a lot of people in their early days who needed help finding stage time, getting attention, paying their rent when I was able to finally do that.
Right.
I have money. I have a house. I have stability. But the only thing that feels, and it's trite to say, but the only thing that I feel no conflict about, the only thing that I don't feel any tumultuousness about is my kid.
Yeah.
It's the only thing. It's the only thing that I know everything about this kid and this situation is right and full of peace and worth throwing myself into 1,000%. Everything else that I've done over the last 20 years, I will have endless questions about. Did I do the right thing, the wrong thing? If I did this, would it have gone this way, this and that? But I'm now at the end of the fucking journey, and there's one thing I'm certain about, which is that my wife, my kid, that's success. Everything else, I don't know. I got money. Is that success? I don't know. I had a TV show, but it failed. Is that success? I don't know. I've written a few books. None of them were bestsellers. I don't know. Is that success? I don't know. I don't really know what failure and success mean, but what I do know, that's the thing. I don't really know what differentiates failure from success. What I do know is that I look at my family and that supersedes that conversation. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's it, man. And I'll say this. I don't think I've ever said this out loud before, but any doubts I ever had about the path I've chosen in life and what could have went away, it goes out the window because, oh yeah, all the choices I made led me to having my daughter.
Dude.
Do you know what I mean? So it's the superseding that word hits me really hard. Because you're absolutely right. It just doesn't fucking matter. And I, you know what? I think that's why I'm ending this fucking thing.
Well, it's interesting too, because you're ending a creative project and I'm realizing that like I can't get another one off the ground because some level it's a lack of enthusiasm and some level it's being a little out of touch and figuring that out. But I once heard Letterman say in an interview, I was just randomly watching Letterman because I love Letterman. And somebody was asking him about his kid. And they were joking around. And then he just quietly said, well, you know, I kick myself for waiting so long because I didn't even realize that none of the good parts of life begin until you have a child. And I think about that, dude. And you can vouch for me on this. Every choice I made, right or wrong, every relationship I sacrificed, and I do regret it. Here's one thing I do know. Is my kid's life is going to be easier than my life. Mm-hmm. My life was easier than either of my parents' lives. Right. I think at the end of the day, that's success, right? Like my kid's going to go to a much better school than I went to. My kid's, I think, going to deal with a lot less fucking torment than I dealt with. I'm going to make sure he doesn't see a lot of the shit I saw. And if I kick it tomorrow, you know, If my fucking brakes fail, he's going to be in a pretty good spot, you know, because I got a little money tucked away and I got a fucking life insurance policy and shit, you know, like I got him all set up for whatever he wants to do.
Yeah.
And, I know it's probably really, people are probably rolling their eyes listening to us say it, but.
It's 100%.
It's the one thing I have zero questions about, though.
That's what we can honestly say, right? I'm not telling anybody to go out and just fucking have a kid. I'm just saying the all the doubts when I think about my life choices, I'm so much more at peace because of where I am now. And I had so many doubts along the way. I wanted to give up so many times. But I, you know, that it all led me to my relationship and having a daughter.
And it might not be having a kid for everybody. It might not be
finding
a spouse for everybody. Everybody's got their level of fulfillment, but
it's finding the thing that supersedes all the bullshit.
Yes. Put your work in, failure, success, all of it. You're going to have to struggle, do your ups and downs. Make sure they're all aiming at the ultimate goal of a happy life. And know that in the moment, a creative life is not a stable life. It's never going to be inherently happy. It's not what you're fighting for. So failure never hurts as much as you think it's going to. Success does not solve as many problems as you hope. But both of them exist to help you land where you're going to land. So cultivate that place along the way because you want it to be as healthy as it can be when you get there. I fucked up on that a little bit and I got some rebuilding to do, but I'm doing it. I reached out to Carson. He's going to come over. He's going to come over yesterday. He had to cancel.
Let's end it there, man. I feel like that's such a good way to kind of put a cap in all this. Yeah. I mean, this was
so fun.
It was a pleasure. It was pleasure, man.
You're the best, dude. That was a conversation I needed to have, honestly.
I'm always here for you, man.
You're the best, dude. Likewise.
All right. Thanks, dude.
All right. I'll see you.
Bye.
Thank you, Chris Gethard. Thanks, Geth, for closing this thing down with me. Check out Beautiful Anonymous on Earwolf, Space Force on Netflix. Chris Gethard presents on Planet Scum Live. He's going to be in Philly doing some socially distanced stand-up at the Punchline September 3rd through 5th. So check that out. Follow Geth on Twitter at Chris Gethard. I'm going to take a break from social media. I'm not going to lie. I'm not too active on it anyway. So bye-bye Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Hey, thanks to everyone I thanked in my intro once again, especially all my guests, and to you, the listeners. Thank you so much for taking this journey with me. It's been an absolute pleasure and privilege to provide you these stories. I don't care about ratings and reviews and merchandise at this point, so go live your lives. I'm going to have all new failures coming at me every day as I journey through parenthood and try to figure out what the hell my career even is. This is definitely not the end of falling down and getting up and learning and contemplating and moving forward. I hope you all do the same. I don't fucking know. Go spread love. Be kind to yourself and others. Listen to yourself and others. Help yourself and others. Embrace the wabi-sabi in your life. Dare to fail, goddammit. You're going to be okay. Okay, Joni, any last words?
Bye-bye.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Okay, that's it. I couldn't think of a better way to finish up this podcast by sweating my ass off in my goddamn car recording this shit. So, for the last time, my name's Don Finelli. Mahalo your dreams.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit ForeverDogPodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram at Forever Dog Team and liking our page on Facebook.